they're really working at their companies. They're not getting the coffee. They're not, you know, running and doing this. They are, at my internships, I was running a piece of production equipment for weeks. I mean, I was in the office actually drafting real jobs that were going to be checked. I mean, obviously I wasn't just, they were getting checked by the engineering manager and this or that, but you were really a part of that production process, and you were really invested in. And so, my theory for what made a good internship, and this just worked for me, obviously I love learning. But my theory about, hey, where should I go for the summer? It wasn't always who's going to pay the best. It wasn't always, hey, this is a cool location where I can go to the beach every day kind of thing. It was, my theory for it was, where am I going to learn the most? And that really ended up working out well for me as far as what I like doing.
Welcome to Verify Infield, the Millwork podcast. Your host, Jacob Edmond, CEO of Duckworks, will be interviewing experts in the industry to bring you insights and knowledge about the latest trends, techniques, and challenges in millwork. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting out, this podcast is for you. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the world of millwork. Here's Jacob. Welcome to Verify in Field, the Millwork podcast. Your host, Jacob Edmond, CEO of Duckworks, will be interviewing experts in the industry to bring you insights and knowledge about the latest trends, techniques, and challenges in millwork. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting out, this podcast is for you. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the world of millwork. Here's Jacob. Welcome to Verify in Field, the Millwork podcast. Your host, Jacob Edmond, CEO of Duckworks, will be interviewing experts in the industry to bring you insights and knowledge about the latest trends, techniques, and challenges in millwork. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting out, this podcast is for you. So sit back, relax, and join us as we explore the world of millwork. Here's Jacob.
Welcome back, everybody. Today we have Christopher Wernermont, and he is a grad assistant at the University of Arkansas. Today is our guest, and we're going to be talking about his journey from graduating from Pittsburgh State. Many of you may be familiar with their Wood Tech program, or used to be AMPT, or used to be, actually now is Wood Product Manufacturing, right? I think.
Yep, that's the new one now. We've been changing it a couple times.
Yeah. And, but yeah, I think Chris, you and I met initially probably at one of the company days there. And I've been following your career ever since and love what you're doing. So appreciate you taking time to come on today and talk with me.
Yeah, man. I'm happy to be here. Let's get into it.
Awesome. Well, I think to start, if you could give a little bit of background, about how you decided to pursue architectural millwork and as a major in college, like what drew you to this field initially, to make a career out of it?
Yeah, I'd probably have to start way back. So when I was a kid, my dad and my grandpa, were always doing stuff around the house. You know, they put up siding around the house. You know, we had table saws and chop saws in our garage, you know, 2x4s everywhere, where I'm sure he saved it for 10 years to use on a project or something like that. It's like, hey, I can use that piece of wood, but that was just kind of the house I grew up in. And so, from a very young age, I was introduced to, hey, it's cool to build things with your hands. I'm sure it started with like me wanting to be around my dad and my grandpa, but it was just so cool what they were doing, and not just what they were like the end result of what they were doing, but like how they were doing it. You know, they're cutting this piece of wood and doing that. I remember, my dad was putting up siding on our house, and he had a bunch of scrap OSB. I had a friend over. And I was like, hey, Dad, can I go make a sword out of that? And he was like, yeah. And so we got some saw horses. We took a jigsaw and then cut out a sword and a shield. Had a friend over and we kind of like fought with them. And a lot of that was fostered at a really young age in my house. So that was awesome. And so I went to high school. I was really blessed that my high school school district loves CTE, really invests in it. And so I had some fantastic CTE teachers, wood shop teachers at my high school. Their shops are always filled. They teach an overload. I mean, that school really loves it and what they were doing. And so I had that teacher went to Pitt State for a different degree, but Pitt State had made a relationship with him long ago. And that was like, hey, if you have any students that want to pursue this in college as a career, you know, that there's opportunities for it out there. And so he told me about that. I talked to my parents. We went down and visited Pitt State and ended up deciding to go there. And so went to Pitt State and man, it was not like how, you know, the high school teacher might tell you, oh yeah, in college, your professors aren't going to put up with this or that. There was no tweed jackets and pontificating and lecturing from a, you know, what I assume. I think you went to architecture school, right? So I'm sure some of those architecture professors kind of fit that stereotype. But the professors there, they're just regular people who really like woodworking and really like investing in the next generation. And so to me, it didn't even feel like college, right? Because I was going to these classes and these classes weren't chemistry 101 or advanced statistics. It was like, hey, let's learn about wood science. Let's learn about, you know, the fundamentals of woodworking. Let's learn about just all these crazy woodworking things that didn't even feel like I was going to college. I was just, it was just so fun and awesome. Just a really great fit for me and what I wanted to do. And so crazy opportunity there as well. And so after that, obviously I came to the University of Arkansas and I'm doing some research here. But I loved my time at Pitt State. Loved what I learned there. Loved what they're doing and investing in the students. And yeah, that's kind of my journey to where I'm at now.
Awesome. So it definitely started early on, your influence, you know, with your dad and your grandfather and your family. And then you were fortunate, it sounds like, to have some CTE exposure in high school that had a relationship with this school. You know, and now you're pursuing, you know, more of an educational path, right? But was that your plan? Or, you know, when you first went to Pitt State, you knew, hey, I'm going to wood product manufacturing. I want to be in this industry. But did you kind of have any goals or an idea of what your career would look like after university at that point?
Yeah. And I will say at that point, totally different than what I'm doing now. At that point, I probably would have said, yeah, I want to open up my own shop. And so I took some business classes while I was at Pitt State too. For those that don't know about it, you pay a one flat rate of tuition. So as you can take as many classes as you want, it doesn't cost you more. So I took advantage of that and took some business classes. And I probably would have said, if you're asked 18-year-old me, I want to open up my own shop and I want to open up my own business. I would guess that a majority of students going there probably have similar thoughts. A lot of them probably say, hey, I want to go open up a high-end furniture shop and I'm going to learn how to do that at Pitt kind of thing. I will say though, one of the things that I think is very common with that experience is that you turn from that, hey, I want to open up my own thing or doing this and that towards this like, hey, I can do some even cooler stuff in project management or I can do some cooler stuff in engineering or we can really, you know, make a career out of this with a good company like that. And so I definitely underwent that transformation. And yeah, I'm taking a more educational path right now. I think that has applications in industry though. I mean, like what I said, like I told you before, what I'm doing right now is focused on adult learning and how people learn in these types of settings and in these shops and things like that. And so, I think it has implications to almost everybody, not just an educational path and I think in the future, the people that do focus on that training and educational element of their businesses will likely see good growth. And that's just my perspective, but yeah.
Absolutely. So another thing is Pitt State is very, very, very good about getting you guys in internships in the summer and school breaks and stuff. And so during your time there, you interned with a handful of different companies, right? Were there, what was that experience like? And, you know, what are some of the takeaways that you took from those experiences?
Yeah. So, I'm kind of over the top about Pitt State and woodworking in general, but it was kind of wild to me, right? So, coming from where I came from high school, a lot of my friends who were at the same year as me, maybe a freshman, sophomore, really tried to get internships in their fields, maybe business, maybe this or that. And they maybe got, volunteer work or something here and there, but they were probably usually going to work at the grocery store, going kind of picking up their high school job. Mm-hmm. So to me, when I say Pitt State internships were wild, was that we had this, you know, we talk about company day, And for your listeners who don't know about that, it's basically a day or two in February where companies who are interested in talking to Pitt State students come all at once. Usually there's, I don't know, 20 to 30 at a time. And all of them are looking to talk to or invest in maybe full-time hire some of these Pitt State students. And so those students have a ton of opportunity, and it's not just local opportunity. I mean, it's all over the country. And so to me, it was wild because my freshman year, I had offers from companies. You know, I ended up working in Florida, but I was 23 hours away from anybody I'd ever known. I'd only known this company for like 2 days, and I was like, yeah, I'll come, you know, live with you for the summer and be away from my family. And so crazy opportunities there that were available. I ended up living in 5 different states that I would have never even had the opportunity to before that. So to me, that was cool to see and experience that. You know, it's just, and for your listeners who don't know about these kinds of internships, typically, they're not going to be where that student is from. And even if that student has a shop that is where they're from, they're probably going to go there their freshman year and then go a couple other places afterwards. So you normally, that company's providing the housing for, that student while they're there. They're paying well too. I mean, it's not minimum wage. They're getting paid as if they're part of the production process. Probably not as a full, like, hey, you know, we're hiring this custom builder from Pitt State for the summer, but, they're getting paid well. And the thing too is that they're part of the production process. They're really working at their companies. They're not getting the coffee. They're not, you know, running and doing this. They are, at my internships, I was running a piece of production equipment for weeks. I mean, I was in the office actually drafting real jobs that were going to be checked. I mean, obviously I wasn't just, they were getting checked by the engineering manager and this or that, but, you were really a part of that production process, and you were really invested in. And so, my theory for what made a good internship, and this just worked for me. Obviously, I love learning. But my theory about, hey, where should I go for the summer? It wasn't always who's going to pay the best. It wasn't always, hey, this is a cool location where I can go to the beach every day kind of thing. It was, my theory for it was, where am I going to learn the most? And that really ended up working out well for me as far as what I like doing. I wouldn't say it would work out for everybody. You know, other people have different priorities, but that's what I was focused on as that 18, 19, 20 year old kid that was like, where am I going to go? And this person I'm making this connection with, or this company, is really going to teach me, is going to help me, is going to learn with me as we go along there. So that was one of the things that, was really cool about those internships too, is that a lot of those companies were open to that. I mean, I never took an internship really outside of woodworking, but I would venture to guess that not a ton of companies, because there's so much demand for an internship, they're not going to be as invested as some of the woodworking companies were. I mean, you have people there who are genuinely there just to help out the next generation of woodworkers. I mean, yeah, they have to justify it by saying, yeah, we're getting these full-time hires after company day or so on, but they're really there to invest in the next generation of woodworking. So crazy cool opportunities for a kid like me. Some of the takeaways that I have for that, I think, was part of your question. I'll preface this by saying these takeaways might be very general and easy for somebody that worked, I don't know, a year in industry to be like, yeah, man, I learned that my first 3 weeks while I was doing my job. But I will say, I think that they're not necessarily known by everybody. And some people probably fought a lot harder for this knowledge than I did. As if they weren't in an internship, or they maybe weren't in a company that was developing, and they were as intent in developing them. And so, yeah, some of my takeaways there. Oh, I got a list here. I'll peek at it real quick as I go. But, so I'll start off with this one. My first takeaway is probably don't be afraid. And I say that I learned that before any internship. It was from company day. It was my very first one. I was a freshman. And I was kind of like sitting in the back and not really engaged. And I was a pretty introverted person in high school. I still think I am a little bit, but I was kind of being removed for what I was doing, not really engaging anybody. And I had a graduate assistant at the time who had graduated with his bachelor's, was getting his master's degree there, was helping teach some classes and facilitate things. And he saw me doing that, and I knew him before, and he was like, "Hey, Chris, come here." And he kind of grabbed my arm, walked me to the first company he saw and said, "Company, this is Chris. Chris, this is company." He walked away. I was like, "Dude, what did you just do to me? Like, I can't do this." And I stumbled my way through that conversation. I don't remember it. I was kind of like, you know, in this days after doing that, but, I was super afraid of that conversation. But the thing was, after he did that, after I had that conversation, I went back. I was like, okay, I kind of see how these things kind of work. That company knew I wasn't going to be, you know, some stud business person that was going to come in there and, you know, talk. They saw it. I was a freshman. I was an 18-year-old. They knew it. And so just breaking the ice there. And not only that, but having somebody there that is willing enough to take me to that and say, "Hey, man, I see this need. We're going to do it. You're going to be okay afterwards. Nothing was too terrible." But to have somebody like that, that was willing to just push me off the deep end there was an awesome show. My first takeaway before any internship there was don't be afraid and that kind of thing. So
that's awesome. Yeah. And I imagine you were able to return that or pass that favor forward to many future freshmen.
Absolutely. And it was fun to be on the other side of it for sure than on the receiving end. But yeah, another takeaway I had, this is probably something I got from my dad and doing that kind of thing, but just be proactive with what you're doing. I remember I'd work on a custom bench learning from somebody and, you know, we'd be putting screws into a die wall and I'd see he's about to run out of screws and I knew where they are. So without being asked, you know, you go and run and grab the next set of screws. You don't just kind of sit there and go, "Oh, what do we do next?" Or you don't just sit there and say, "No, my boss needs to get me some work. I'm about to run out." Be like, "Hey man, let's think about what's going to happen next and let's go do that." I think that worked wonders for me. And as far as building relationships with people and seeing that, hey, I'm proactive. I like doing this. I like where we're at. I like what I'm doing and I want to learn more. And I think when a lot of people see that, they're like, "Hey, you know, we're putting in the work. Who cares? You know, you're going, getting some screws, right?" But it's the thought about it. You're like, "Hey, we're being proactive about this," was huge for me and opened up a lot of doors there. And kind of rolling off of that too, just being genuinely interested in what's going on around you and being observant, it did wonders for me. I mean, the things I learned that I would have never learned without just kind of sitting and listening and kind of just being look at what was going on around me was, I probably learned 50% of what I know based on that. But very little of it was, "Hey, this person had an intent to teach me something, so they transferred the knowledge to me and I retained that knowledge." It was like, "Hey, I kind of heard this in a conversation over there," or "I asked somebody why they did that way. I asked somebody, you know, is there a better way to do this?" And oh my gosh, that's just so many cool things you can learn from that. And a huge takeaway I got from my internships, just being observant. And these people, I mean, you think about a custom builder, they're probably on their bench for 8 to 10 hours a day, right? They have very specific ways of doing things. They have things that that processes that they've done over and over again that they know by heart. But that it's probably not too easy for them to articulate and say, "Yeah, I need to teach somebody this. Hey, I do it this way because," and so you have to be a little bit proactive and getting that out of them and just maybe not being afraid to ask a dumb question. But at the same time, like, that's how we learn. We learn by asking those questions. We learn through those experiences, through those conversations with people and huge. If you're going to just sit there and have work thrown at you or not ask questions or be afraid about what you're doing and be afraid about asking a dumb question, you're going to get a very different experience out of that versus if you're proactive and going for that. And I will say too, a lot of this has the assumption that that company or that person's willing to invest in you. They're not willing to invest in you. Then, you know, a lot of the things I just said probably maybe don't apply, or maybe you got to put in a little more effort to get there. I like to think that most people are that way. But I was probably blessed by having companies that are willing to come to Pitt State. They're probably willing to invest in somebody. Whereas if I was just to go to anybody random and expect that from them, that might be a different case there.
Yeah. Something else that I think is really unique is that you guys, I mean, most students are there for 4 years. So they have at least three summers, usually at least three internships. I think you probably had four or five, maybe.
Yeah, I ended up taking one before. Again, it was a Pitt State connection, but there was one in my hometown, and a graduate who was from my high school who went to Pitt State that was working ended up coming to talk to my high school teacher. And I was looking for a summer job. And so I just crazy pathway how that worked out there. I actually ended up meeting Doug Hague on that internship because he knew the owner of that company there too. And so now obviously I know him pretty well, but yeah, I ended up taking six or so, I think.
And I think in general, like even three, like that's exposure to three different, or for you, six different shops, six different regions, probably markets of product that they make, different groups of people. And that's very rare, even for just people that spend a career in this industry, is to be able to get that exposure, that experience in different companies. And I think that that's a huge amount of value. Is there anything that you took from that you realized after six different companies of like, hey, everybody does this very similar, it has these same problems, or this is six different ways of approaching this? Because I think there's a lot of value in that experience for any company to pick up somebody that has, you know, seen six different shops and seen that many different ways of doing things in this industry.
Yeah. Number one, every edge bander breaks down. That's just I can't say that there was anything that every shop did, because all of them were so different. I mean, I tended to go towards more commercial shops. I never worked in a residential one. So, I got some friends actually that went to Pitt State that their parents owned shops. And so I've been to their shops and talked to them and seen things. That's just another thing of me just being curious in general. Like, I probably will never put a face frame on a cabinet, but you know, I've talked to them about all of their shops and things that they do. And it's just being curious and being observant and willing to learn from anybody there. But, I think that was one of the cool things about our industry, though, is that everybody's kind of doing things a little different way, and there's no one right way to do it. I mean, I'm sure you saw it in USA Millwork too. I know I saw it when I was there, and you talk about seeing different shops. One of my internships was at USA Millwork, so I saw four different shops while we were, you know, there. So you add to that number there, but something that works for one isn't necessarily going to work for another. A shop that has a ton of veneer work and can lay up their own panels and things doesn't mean commercial shop over here, when they're doing veneers, shouldn't buy out their panels, kind of thing. That's a pretty specific example, but yeah, I mean, I will say one of the things that I think a lot of those shops share was that people like building things with their hands, and that's pretty obvious. You know, that's why a lot of us get into this industry. But I think it's important to articulate, because that's what's cool about what we do, is that we get to go into that shop and there's this truck that comes in and drops off a roll of a particle board, drops a bunk of particle board. And at the end of the day, after our jobs are done, not only do we have cabinets that are going somewhere or countertops or what have you, you know, we're making the space nicer, but like, it was because of us and it was because of our input. That particle board doesn't get transformed into that without, you know, us being there to do that. And not only that, but if we're doing everything right, we're making a profit on it too. You know, we're keeping our good business. It's not just for the sake of doing woodworking. I love woodworking, but if it wasn't profitable, I probably wouldn't do it. Except for, you know, as a hobby shop on the side kind of thing. But we get to make money that way. We get to make our livelihoods that way. And to me, that's a crazy cool thing. And I think that's one thing that a lot of the shops shared, was that these people, young people and people who had been in it a long time alike, loved that feeling of it. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's awesome. I think that's something that we don't, you know, definitely as I was coming up in this industry, you know, I went to school for architecture, and I think it's one of those, architecture is one of those professions that is very, in media is very sexy. It's very appealing. But in reality, most people don't make a lot of money in architecture. And a lot of architecture is also architects doing jobs that aren't what you envision. You know, like I worked at a firm for a little while, and it was, you know, an upfit of an office space that really the only reason they hired us is because the building department required an architect to do something, right? You know, and I think that in millwork, so many of us end up here by accident, like I didn't go to school for millwork, right? And Pitt State is one of the unique programs that people are seeking this career out. But this industry is very much filled with people who kind of end up here through various pathways. And not enough people in this industry take what we do seriously with that level of pride of like, hey, we get to create awesome stuff. Even if you're not, like, if you're an engineer, you're a project manager, like there's so many different roles. But that was something that was always fascinating to me, because I always took this, like, I always used to say when I was at USA Millwork, hey, I want us to be the Google of millwork. And what I meant by that was obviously I wanted us to be successful and really, you know, but I looked at myself as like, I feel like I care enough about this. Like if you go to Google, you expect the best of the best in whatever industry you're at, right? And I felt like, okay, that's what our clients expect from us. But I think very few people that are actually doing the work day to day think that way of themselves and of the work. They see the problems, they see the flaws in our processes, they see all this stuff. And so having young people coming into the industry, I think a lot of times shakes up that mentality with the later career people in the industry that are kind of jaded, that have been doing it for many years, and they see the problems every day, the pain points and the flaws. We're all our own worst critics. But I think having that interns like you coming in reinvigorates that, of like that awe, that wonder of like, wow, this is cool. We get to work on an office for Google. We get to work on this hospital project. We get to do a lot of cool stuff that I think taking that moment to take a step back and kind of really, reflect on that goes a long way.
Right. And like I said before, at least for me, that started when I was probably 4 to 8 years old, because that was the same feeling that I had at that time, whether it was, I don't know if you ever went to Home Depot on Saturday and did their little kid workshops or something like that.
I do that with my kids now. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the same feeling that I had making that birdhouse as a kid that I do when I finish a project, in a commercial millwork thing. It's that same feeling. And I think it sounds like you were kind of chasing that feeling through architecture school too, and feeling that, but it's that almost like innate sense there that we really got to tap into and express and show and foster and really articulate. Cause I think it's something we really do share as a common industry, and it's not unique to us.
Yeah.
Somebody who's in residential construction probably loves seeing the house finished. Somebody who, is in works at a mill probably loves seeing that metal piece finish, or a foundry likes seeing the final cast. It's not unique to us. So I guess my takeaway there is, don't just expect your kid to go to Home Depot on Saturday and come out a commercial millworker in 20 years kind of thing. But it's that kind of feeling that we really got to tap into it and foster there.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, definitely. I think I was chasing that through architecture school. I had a lot of people invest and say, oh, you're good at math, you're good at art, you're good at, this concept. And I worked construction. I always liked working with my hands. And I really went to architecture school because I loved stick-built residential construction. I loved walking through a home being framed and then seeing it get finished. And that was what I envisioned I would be able to do in architecture. And, coming out after 4 years, I was very jaded to it because, one, the first 4 years is very much not that. Now, I'm grateful I learned a lot, but what I really learned was the design process, which is how to extract from somebody not what they think they need or want, but what is it they're actually trying to do. And in general, and people want to solve a problem and they see, hey, I saw this house, I want something like that. And as a design professional, and even we do this as millworkers, we should more, is if we're the experts, you take the architect's design intent or the client's design intent, but you have to ask them questions and extract from them. They're presenting to you their needs or wants as proposed solutions that they're aware of. So they see something in a magazine or they see something somewhere and they say, hey, I want something like this. They're trying to solve a problem that they don't really even understand the core of. And so what we're trying to get at is, what is that intent? And through that, we can actually offer better solutions than they're aware of. Hey, there's this hardware you probably didn't know. You can actually put a magic pullout, or we can actually miter fold this and make it look better than you thought was possible. That to me is like, that's the fun part of what we do, is like, oh, wow, you didn't even know this was possible and we just made you aware of it and we're giving you something better than you expected. And working in architecture for a couple of years, I lost that. I was doing contract documents and it was like, I would do drawings of houses that I never would see get built. I would never go to a job site. And when I first stepped foot in my first millwork shop, I leveraged my drafting skills. They needed a drafter, but when I wasn't drawing, I was on the shop floor. And like, that was the first moment that I was like, oh, I get to draw something today and we get to build it tomorrow. And then the next day it's getting installed and somebody's using that for its life. Like, it's tangible, useful purpose. And everything we do in millwork is serving a purpose that we very rapidly get to solve a problem and actually see that solution be used. And that to me was like eye-opening. I think that's something that's so unique in today's day and age, to be able to kind of cradle to the grave experience that. And that, so I think I, through this podcast and through talking with people like you, I hope more young people see that, that there's an opportunity for that.
Yeah. So I was a Boy Scout when I was in high school, and I built a shed for my Eagle Scout project, for those of you know who that is. It was at a humane society in greater Kansas City, and it's on my way to the airport in Kansas City. And so every time I go by the airport, I drive by that shed and I see it. I totally know what you're saying. And it's just, it's so cool to me, because before they had a, you know, crappy metal shed that wasn't watertight. And they couldn't put certain things in there, and it was detrimental to them. And it said something else about volunteer work, but the actual construction of it, like building this thing where it's still standing. That was probably 10 years ago. I feel old. I know I'm not old, but I feel old. I think that, but, 10 years,
you're going to drive past with your kids and they're going to get tired of you saying, hey, I built that.
Right. Exactly. And it's just so stinking cool to me. I mean, and again, started way that feeling was fostered at a young age and was never shut down, or it was never negative reinforced. It was yeah, positively reinforced. And I think that's the kind of same kind of thing you were saying when you were doing those contract or the construction documents, and they never saw the house. It's that positive reinforcement of going to see in the house saying, hey, I drew this. I planned this out. Somebody's going to use it for that lifetime, for the lifetime of its use is such a positive reinforcement. Yet it's not value added. It's not, you're not making sawdust with that, but there is such an intangible value to that about how you feel about what you're doing that long-term led you to success. So
yeah,
I think that's something that a lot of people gotta take away from this, is that their profits are important. Obviously we don't have businesses that have profits, but we have really successful businesses by focusing on some of these intangibles, focusing on that positive reinforcement, not always being like, hey, you did these drawings and you did this, and this wrong. Hey, let's make a majority of what we talk about what you did right. Spend some time on what you did wrong. We have to do that to fix it. And if it's very wrong, we can still find some positive things with it. But that positive reinforcement is a huge piece in anybody learning anything.
We'll be back after a quick break.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Yeah. So kind of snowballing on that, you know, as someone who you're passionate about the millwork industry, you know, you and I both made a conscious decision, you know, very young comparatively for this industry to join the industry and make a career here. What are your thoughts on engaging and getting more young people interested in this field?
You know, there's no easy answer that's going to work for everybody. I'd love to say, hey, come adopt this program and you'll have, you know, 50 people at your door. I don't think that's the case. I don't think that should be the case. But I looked this up in preparation for this, but there's a recent survey out there that was done by Adobe. It was the Future Workforce Survey. So they interviewed, I think, 1,000 Gen Z employees that were working. And I think that the survey is saying that 83% of Gen Z is looking for a workplace mentor and sees them as crucial to their career. And so if we're talking about millwork and how we put that perspective in what we're doing, we have to have these formal mentorship programs in our businesses. I frankly don't think they're optional. I think in order for somebody that's really going to be successful, they're going to be very specific in how they are developing that talent and articulating that to that person too. You know, you might hire somebody and, you know, I'm not a business owner, so I really don't know. I'm just speaking from what I know. You might hire somebody and say, yeah, you know, I could see them going into this. But if we never tell that person that or never, you know, articulate that to them or say, hey, here's your path forward. Here's your path to promotion. Here's your path to doing your job well. Here's some metrics that we're gonna talk about on weekly one-on-ones and to track to see how we're doing and measure how we're doing that are specific and attainable. That's going to be huge. That mentorship factor is going to be huge. I think a lot of people my age and even just people in general are looking for that direction and that guiding light. And it doesn't happen by accident. It can. I've had people I consider mentors that we kind of just fell into it because I was curious and because they were looking for somebody, you know, it worked out. But I would guess a lot of times it has to be something that we're really intentional about at our company and just saying, hey, this is an discrete, articulate path forward to that. I think a lot of people my age were looking for that.
I agree. I 100% agree. And I think, you know, for anybody who's listening, if you're in this industry, yes, a formal mentorship, I think, is needed. And I had an episode early on with Kelly Victor Burke, and she worked to actually create an apprenticeship program that is sponsored by the government. So that's, if you haven't listened to that episode, go listen to that episode because there's resources out there to do this. But I think even informally, like through my career, I'm going to call out some people that I think I've considered mentors, and they never positioned themselves as, but they made a conscious effort to invest in me and made me excited about this industry. My very first job, I mentioned, I worked at a door company as a drafter. And when I wasn't drafting, I was learning how to mill lumber. And I spent 2 years there, and there was a gentleman by the name of Larry Bashline. And he came from the unions up north in carpentry and woodworking. And, you know, he taught me so much. He let me use his toolbox. He made me passionate about, he taught me how to do my first cut list, how to do my first story sticks. And this was just on the job of, he saw somebody interested in learning and said, hey, if you want to learn, I'll teach you. He didn't have to do that, you know, and he would encourage me. He said, build something every weekend. And I took that seriously. The whole 2 years that I was there, I would, you know, I made so many things that 2 years because I was excited Monday morning to come back and tell Larry, hey, look at this thing that I built this weekend. And those of us that are young coming up with this industry, you know, we're looking for somebody to look up to in this industry and looking for somebody to invest in us and to make us feel included and excited about, you know. And I went from there to my next job where I first learned Microvellum. There's a guy there by the name of Jay Youngs. He taught me everything I know and so much I use today about drafting, about Microvellum, about laying out model space, about engineering millwork. Every company I've been at, I've had people that have invested in me that they didn't position themselves as like, hey, I'm going to be your mentor. It was just, I see somebody that's young and curious. I'm going to invest in that. And a lot of times that's the most impactful thing you can do in this industry to promote the next generation, guys. I think a lot of times we think, what initiative can I do? What can I adopt this program? What? And a lot of times it's those little things. I had Greg Kasten, who to this day, you know, we keep in touch. He hired me. He gave me my first job as an engineering manager. He saw something in me and gave me opportunities to grow and then continue to teach me at USA Millwork, you know, how to be a general manager, how to just invest in people, how to coach people. I think that's what's important that we need. And a lot of times we're all looking for like systemic, large scale macro solutions. And we lose the micro things we can do on the day to day.
Absolutely. And if I were to guess, I would say you and I are probably not afraid enough to go up to somebody and ask, hey, can I learn this? Can I see that? I would venture to guess that not everybody feels confident enough to do that. Not everybody is like, hey, maybe I just need to stay in here, do my job. Maybe I just need to, you know, keep my head down and do that. And so I think as a specific strategy, somebody might take away from this conversation is bring those conversations and make them a part of your job. Make it, there was somebody, I never interned with them, but somebody at Pitt State that, had weekly meetings with all of their interns, and they said, "Hey, what do you want to know? Or what did you learn this week?" And it was a specific part of their job. And I remember his interns would come back, "Man, I learned so much. It was so awesome." And I have to think the intentionality behind what he was doing. I agree. Maybe it's not the formality behind it. It's not, "Oh yeah, we have this internship program." Although I will say, I think if somebody was between one or two jobs and one job said, "Hey, I've got this formal leadership program for you to go through. This is how what it's going to look like." That might make somebody feel like, "Hey, they're going to invest in me." But yeah,
no, absolutely.
Most of my people that I consider that way, they weren't like, "I'm going to be your mentor." And I will say, I've had a couple of people that have done that, the relationships were good, but the ones that are just, you know, you poke in their office, be like, "Hey, can I pick your brain about this?" Or, "Hey, I got an idea for you. What do you think?" And that just run with it, man. Those are so fruitful and fun and awesome to be with. And then you just enjoy what you're doing. And not even because, like we talked about earlier, hey, we're building cool stuff, but you just enjoy who you're working with and who you're working for, maybe even. And so there's a huge intangible value of that. And like I said, that study says it, but I'm saying it here too. I think that is a huge takeaway is a specific and articulate solution that somebody could implement right now today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I agree. I think if that were available to me at that age and it was just, "Hey, this informal thing that at the time I wasn't consciously thinking of it as a mentorship," or somebody said, "Hey, there is this real program," I would have chosen that. But I think if you're somebody that's in this industry and maybe not in a position of influence, but you're saying, "How can I encourage young people?" I think there's absolutely things you can do every day.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're studying specifically, you know, adult learning. How are you thinking about applying it to this industry? You know, are there any things that you are studying now or learned that you think are applicable advice for those in this industry on how we can attract or retain young professionals, how we can do a better job at developing people?
Yeah, I mean, so part of what I do with part of that is investigate a lot of the research that's out there and a lot of the scholarly research that's out there. One of the things we're finding is that actual practice, and this might be super simple knowledge for you or I or anybody in this industry really, but I think there's something else that comes when you articulate these things. But authentic practice when you train is huge. There's different ways to measure learning, but the amount of learning that happens or the amount of perceived learning that happens by the individual when they're in an authentic setting is vastly different than when they're in a non-authentic one. So to give you an example of that, when we're training somebody on drafting, I'm sure there's a ton of different ways to train. One of the ones I went through though was, "Hey, here's these set of drawings from an architect. This is a project we've already done. We've got a finished out set of drawings either in Microvellum or what have you. Go ahead and try to use Microvellum and we'll give you somebody to ask questions, but use Microvellum to go recreate the set of drawings." Pretty simple thing, right? Mm-hmm. However, there is a lot more that somebody can learn from actually drawing a live project because you're not just kind of sitting there and figuring out this or that. And so that's kind of an example of authentic practice there. Whereas I've never done the Microvellum trainings, but, and I'm sure they're good there, but, if they're replicating that authentic practice, what are we actually doing in our actual jobs? One of the things that we learned from adult learning theory is that adults really want to apply specific knowledge to exactly what they're learning. If you take like something like a high school classroom where we're learning about English, that's great. And we need that for our general development. But if you try to teach adult about, I don't know, John Steinbeck, and he's like, "What the heck? I drafted Microvellum all day. I don't know this." Some people might look at that and say, "Yeah, I can pull that here and do this there." But what a lot of the adults are really looking for is, "Hey, I want to know how to do my job well. I want to know what's going to make me successful. I want to know what's going to raise my human capital." Connecting to that is huge there. So the authentic practice of that is awesome.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I think I you know, looking back now, I experienced this. That was one of my frustrations with architecture schools. We'd have these semester-long studio projects that were based on like a made-up job site with, you know, no real constraints. And, you know, I remember even when I was in school, people would constantly be like, oh, have you already like, do you draw house plans of like your ideal house? And I'm like, it's pointless to design without a real problem. And, you know, and so a lot of times this happens, and this is why you see bad houses a lot of times, because they're designed without the site of context. It's just, hey, here's a house we can build anywhere. And I think the same thing, you know, a lot of times with what you're describing with learning, when there's real stakes involved and there's real problem that you're solving, you're going to learn a lot better. And the majority of my learning as an engineer, you know, was I wasn't fortunate enough to have people teaching me. You know, it was kind of like thrown to the wolves. And so I was constantly seeking out online advice. And I was fortunate that Microhome did have a forum. And so I would every morning start my work day looking at what new posts were there. And it was usually somebody else that had a question of like, hey, how do I do this in Microhome? I would try to solve that. And that's how I learned how to use the software. That's how I learned to do things, was because I wasn't just trying to solve my problems. I was trying to solve, I had way more problems to solve. And through that, I had a real tangible thing that I was using. And using to learn new solutions. And even today, like as we train our people at Duckworks, and I've trained people, like it is much more effective, like you said, than having them watch videos or redraw a project that's already done, to have them actually help on a project. And I know this is one of the things that employers struggle with, because they're like, well, I don't want to risk them making a mistake. But I would imagine there's probably some research on this, but I think, you know, the longer you guard them from that, they're going to eventually make mistakes, and they kind of need to make mistakes to learn. And so you're kind of just delaying the inevitable. But, you know, there's ways to do it in structure and have quality control checks in place. And you use that of somebody reviewing their work and saying, oh, hey, actually fix this mistake, rather than just, well, if this were a real job, you would need to fix this, this, and this. It's actually, this is about to be cut tomorrow, so I need you to make these corrections, and then you're going to be able to go out on the shop floor and see why that was important, for example.
Right. Now, one of the adult learning principles or theories out there is experiential learning theory. And part of that is this reflective cycle. Mm-hmm. And so in simple terms, it's a feedback loop, right? Hey, I make this mistake on this project. Where am I going to get the feedback from that is a mistake? Because if I made a mistake and didn't know it, obviously I don't know it. Somebody else has to know it and point it out. Where is that going to be? If we're in training and we're working on something that's authentic, and I have somebody that's there with me that says, hey, this is a mistake in that training, we can do that. And the speed at which you do that is huge, because if we make that mistake and it goes out to a shop and it waits for 3 weeks in the bin, it comes out, and 4 weeks down the road, somebody comes in there to my desk and is like, hey, you made this mistake. Why? I might learn some from that, but it's going to be really hard for me to connect that point with where I was at 4 weeks ago, versus if I have somebody there that is actively helping me through that feedback loop. That's like, hey, let me finish what I'm doing. Comes back here and says, hey, this is a mistake right here. We need to do this in order to correct it. The speed at which you do that is huge. That's one of the big problems with online learning. There's a ton of benefits to online learning, but one of the problems is if I'm just sitting there watching a video, I have no feedback as to what I'm actually doing in real life. And even if I take a quiz, I only go through that feedback loop once, to where, hey, I got that answer wrong on a quiz. Whereas if I'm in a classroom and I'm learning directly in front of me, you're going through that feedback loop millions of times, probably in that one classroom setting, based on, hey, my students look disengaged, I need to switch this or that as a teacher. Hey, you can read their body language. They can ask you direct questions. We can go into different things. And so online learning has a ton of benefits. But the speed at which that feedback loop goes isn't one of them. And then also, like I said earlier today, that positive feedback loop is huge too. If somebody does 100 things right on those drawings, and we focus on that one the whole time, they get no feedback on those 99 things they did right, you know, and not just, hey, you did a good job. Hey, here's specifically where you did a good job. And now we're okay. Now we know that is a good job for that. That is how you do that process. And now we feel more confident in what we're doing. Now we feel better about what we're doing. We feel more engaged. And it's just better to hear positive things than negative things. I mean, yeah. I don't know how everybody else feels. I know I learn a lot through your negative feelings and reinforcement. Some of those things are really formative, but if we're talking about something that's sustainable, I mean, a lot of people can't process that failure so often.
That's another thing that I think is a tangible takeaway people could take. Because I've said for all the years I've been in this industry, it's very much a thankless industry. And I think, you know, a lot of times our goal was to have a project kind of go through without anybody realizing it and have the owner be like, hey, where are we at in this project? Oh, it's done. That meant it was successful if there weren't any problems that were so memorable, right? And it wasn't that you were seeking like for a good job, because that didn't happen. The good job was there's no problems that anybody is constantly having a headache about. We're focused on this other problem, that a project that does have problems. And so I think definitely for the younger generations, making a concerted and conscious effort to give positive feedback will go a long way in attracting and retaining younger talent.
Yeah. And then like we talked about earlier, you're not making money on that positive feedback, but long term, if that person is saying, hey, you know what, I really like who I'm working for. I like the specificity of which I get feedback, positive or negative, and we work to grow that. I mean, you are that's training right there. And it's not even training where we go sit down in a classroom and watch this video. I mean, that is a form of informal training right there. And so when we talk about, hey, you know, I think I've heard you say on the podcast before, but we do very poorly at training in the millwork industry.
Yeah.
That is a very easy way to train that probably is something you should already be doing in the first place. But if not, is investing in the skills of your employees. As long as you treat it like that, if you treat it like, oh, I got to go berate this engineer. I'm sure most people don't have an engineering manager job that berate people very long, but it's like, oh my gosh, here we go again today. I got to point out all these negative things. We got to fix them. Yeah, we got to fix them. But if we are looking at these opportunities as training, as a way for us to invest in the skills of our department, even selfishly, it would make your job easier if people were well trained. So let's go, as an engineering manager, let's go invest in making your job easier selfishly. But for the company as a whole, implementing very small micro training elements like that and seeing them as learning opportunities. And I know that's kind of a cliche, but truly, like, investing in people's learning, I think they pay huge dividends in the long run.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, before we wrap up, there's two questions I'd like to get your feedback on that I try to ask every guest. The first is, thinking towards the future, what do you envision changing in our industry, in the millwork industry, over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. One of the things that I would say in response to that would be, and this is thinking about the learning and knowledge side, is that the person that needs to know a specific piece of information is going to change with automation. I'll give you an example. So let's say we have a piece of particle board with a nice laminate on top and a backer on the bottom, right? If I'm cutting that on a sliding table saw, I want to put my good side up. That way, if I have any chip out, it's on the bottom side, right? That's a specific piece of knowledge that somebody's got to train in and do that. Well, if I've got a robotic storage system and I got a robotic saw that cuts those parts for me, now that system is the one that needs to know that. It's not the sawyer on the ground. It's the person that's programming that saw, or even the person at the machinery company that's doing that. So that's just one example, but those pieces of knowledge are going to change hands. And I think that has a ton of implications for what we do and how we train and what we focus on, and where we put people who are good at certain things. And so, that's super vague. I know, not as specific as some of the other I said.
That's very insightful and detailed, because I think a lot of people, that transition people are fearful for and unsure of and don't really understand it. But, that is a detail that I think a lot of people assume, like, oh, okay, well, because there's been an insight for many, many years as we've adopted CNC technology of like, oh, you're losing the craftsmanship. And like, but what you just described is like that same, the craftsmanship is that knowledge, that expertise of how to get the result, right? And that still needs to be known by, it's just a different person that is executing that, and you're executing it through software telling a machine to do things.
Right.
And that
principle is never going to go away from woodworking, right? We're never going to not have that saw blade unless we stop using saw blades or particle board, which who knows, that's probably outside of your 5 to 10 year window, but it's never going to go away. And I think there are probably thousands of little pieces of information like that, that it's going to switch hands. Who needs to know that?
Absolutely. No, that's awesome. Well, on the flip side, what do you see remaining constant and not changing?
Man, I'd have to go back, and I know I've kind of hit it a bunch of times here, but it's that internal feeling of like, hey, I love what I do. I love building things with my hands. I love seeing that complete thing. And not only that, I love the process of doing it. I mean, if you like looking at nice buildings, then millwork maybe not be for you, because you're going to be in that shop making it all day, every day. You got to like the process of making the cabinets, not just looking at nice cabinets. If that makes sense. And so, I really don't think we are ever going to lose that. I think it might change, just like I said earlier, that the person who likes doing that might change. It might go from, hey, if you like that process, you might go from a person on the shop floor to an engineer or maybe even a project manager. But that is not going to go away. Whether it's with remote work, whether it's with on-site work, I'll throw in real quickly, I think that that study I referenced before says that a lot of young people are looking for on-site work as well, which I think kind of contrasts what some people believe. And it's all up to everybody and themselves too. But I think we're going to see that persist. And the companies that hold on to that, that really make it a part of their value stream, that like, hey, this is one of the pieces of value I'm giving to my employees outside of salary and PTO. Another thing there too is that, I mean, when you're thinking about a young person considering the millwork industry, your competition is literally every other option they could ever have out there. And we got to be competitive with that. I mean, we got to be competitive with any other option they could take. I mean, and with how connected everything is and how simple it is to go find somebody halfway across the world or halfway across the country and say, hey, I'm thinking about this and that. Your competition is everybody, and referencing that and knowing that it's not just competing with other millwork shops, because these people have a finite set of skills that gets you there. It's, hey, we got to know that our competition is everywhere. So we got to be competitive with salaries, with PTO and everything like there. But all that aside, if we can attach on to that thing that we've developed from a young age, hey, I love building billboard houses at Home Depot. I love building a table at my high school shop. Hey, I loved building this in architecture school. To now, hey, I get to do this as my job. Then I think that will remain constant no matter what we do.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming on today and sharing all your insights and knowledge. I think there's some really good stuff for people that are listening today. If anybody is interested in reaching out and finding out more or just connecting with you, Chris, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, the best way is probably going to be LinkedIn. Shoot me a message on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Well, I will make sure that we link your profile down below, and look forward to hopefully having you on again in the future.
Sounds good. I appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Chris.
See you later.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Do you want to stay up to date about industry insights, new content, and our community of millworkers? Go to duckworksmw.com to sign up for our newsletter. I'll see you in the next episode of Verify in Field.